Support for Soundwaves from the Underground is brought to you by 24tix.com, the most convenient way to buy tickets to your favorite local concerts. Save time, save money, rock out. 24tix.com, your ticket to the experience.
How's Portland?
Portland was hip, man. There was this dude, we were in the Safeway, right? And we were buying sunscreen, and then like we all went to different parts of the store and then regrouped near the front. And there's this dude that looked like he could have been on a label for Beefeater Gin. He had this weird hat and this mustache that he like waxed and greased up. And he was looking at us like we were the weird asses. It was like, what nerve, man.
I'm Dan Nalen, and this is Soundwaves from the Underground, the official podcast of Slug Magazine in Salt Lake City, Utah. Slug is an acronym for Salt Lake Underground, and it is one of the oldest independent publications in the entire United States, distributing free monthly issues about music, art, action sports, and subculture. On this episode, we are talking all about Banned Books Week, all of the great books that have been out there for years, being fought by pro-censorship forces around the country and beyond. We're going to have a discussion with some leaders of our local literary community. We have Catherine Weller from Weller Bookworks, as well as Betsy Burton of the King's English Bookshop in the studio. Let me just start right there and welcome you both. Thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
We are going to delve right into these banned books. And as I was doing my research, Banned Books Week is an event that's been going on about 30 years now, drawing attention to the issue that there are still people out there in the world trying to censor books, I guess, basically censor thought and the access to certain books.
More than ever.
Yeah. Why don't we start with what's been your respective experiences in dealing with this issue and, how common is it as a bookseller to kind of encounter forces who might be trying to tell you what to sell in your own store if that happens? Catherine, why don't we start with some of your experience?
All right. Yeah. It's a funny thing dealing with challenges to books, and it is important probably to note that book bannings per se don't really happen anymore. Municipalities don't get out and say, we're going to ban this book and we're not going to stock it. But what happens is that books are challenged, and they are challenged routinely. They're challenged in just about every aspect you can think of. People walk into my store and tell me that I shouldn't be selling things for particular reasons. People go to the libraries and they challenge the library's ability or right to stock those things. They are challenged in schools. They are challenged in governments. And it's how it works. My most recent encounter with challenges to books involves The Bluest Eye by Toni Morrison, and evidently the Eagle Forum sent out a press release questioning The Bluest Eye's inclusion on the Common Core list for 11th grade reading. And I tried to prepare for an interview with another media outlet by finding the Eagle Forum's statement, but it wasn't online yet, so I asked the reporter to tell me a little bit about what they were saying. She read it to me, and it was verbatim what was being said by the people who are challenging the same book in Alabama. Challenges are often organized by groups. They spread virally across the country as groups, both right-wing and left-wing, talk to each other. There are so many books that get challenged, and sometimes it's for crazy things like the art on the cover.
Right.
We've had people come into our store and say, you need to take that book out of your window. It has a naked person on the cover. Sometimes it's content. It's Catch-22 is challenged.
Yeah.
In my store, I've been challenged on both the left and the right. I have left-wing people come in and tell us we shouldn't be stocking Protocols of the Elders of Zion. And yes, it's a terrible book. Books are dangerous. Writing is dangerous. That's because it makes people think.
Right.
It allows people to explore scary issues. And some people don't want us to think about those things.
Right, they want to suppress it rather than be offended or...
Right, and as a bookseller and as a proponent of free speech, I believe that all ideas, regardless of how repugnant, are better in the light of day than swept under the rug somewhere.
Right, absolutely.
I would add to that I think one of our basic rights is not just to read, but to read widely and freely. I think it's so important that we do that. And I think limiting that right is one of the real threats to our freedom. And so when people, under the guise of freedom, attempt to limit those rights, that is what's un-American to me.
Right.
Yeah. Totally
it's nonsensical.
It's nonsensical, and it's also very scary.
Yeah.
And, you know, one of the local examples that I think is very interesting from a bookseller's perspective, and this happened years ago, is that they tried to ban White Noise by Don DeLillo. And the funny thing is that nobody at that point in time had ever heard of Don DeLillo.
Right.
And we sold more of his book in the ensuing month than I think anybody had ever sold anywhere, except maybe Catherine at Zion's bookstore.
People came to find it.
They did. So actually, it brings a kind of interest to books when they are banned. So it's kind of counterproductive. But the thing that I really hate is when they do it in schools, because you're teaching children something that they should never be taught, which is that ideas can hurt you and scare you. And in fact, if an idea is scary, the better informed you are, the better equipped you are to deal with
right.
what's scary
the
about it.
The better to create your counter-argument to deal
right.
with those people,
that's
right?
That's right. So I hate it in schools more than anywhere else.
Have you had people at your store be offended by a book cover like Catherine was talking about, or bring it up proactively on things you carry? Or
we've never had anybody object to a book cover, but we have had objections to books. The most common, however, is when we do book fairs.
Mm.
Parents, you know, are always on the lookout for books that might hurt their children.
Right.
And we have had some encounters with parents over books. And our tack that we always take is, you know, if you don't want your kid to read this book, that is fine. We
sure.
absolutely respect your right as a
That's
parent.
That's parenting.
Yeah, right. And in many cases, we will even agree that, you know, a very violent book, for instance, probably for a 12-year-old, isn't a good idea, but we're not going to limit the 12-year-old's access to that book.
Right.
We might put it in the edgy section instead of young adults, so it's not in the kids'
right.
room. But we do not limit anybody's access to books. We just don't feel that that's the basic tenet of our existence as booksellers.
Right.
That people shouldn't be limited in what they have access to.
Now, as I looked over, particularly, you know, when I was doing a little bit of research on this subject, and the American Library Association has some great resources out there for people if you just Google up Banned Books Week. But the big list of classics, you know, as I was mentioning to Catherine earlier, it's like my reading list of my high school English classes, basically.
I
mean, mm-hmm. it is your American canon, basically, are the things that people have gone after.
They went after House of the Spirits at West one year.
Is it a matter of if something gets so popular it starts to scare people if they find something objectionable?
No.
Or what is it about those?
It's what people find objectionable. In House of the Spirits, there's a little bit of sex in it. It isn't very, you know, it really isn't. But I think it's the violence in it. And it isn't a very violent book, but it's against revolutions.
Mm-hmm.
It's against the kind of revolutions that are fascist.
Right.
I can't imagine how anybody would object to House of the Spirits, frankly. It's such a wonderful book. But you look at this list, how could anybody object to All the King's Men? It is
right.
the quintessential American novel.
Yeah.
You know?
Right? Yeah. It's amazing the stuff on here. Everything
yeah.
from more modern fare like Toni Morrison stuff to, you know, Catch-22, you know, one of my favorites from reading it as a kid, high school kid. But
it's anti-war.
I know. Is that what's dangerous to people?
Yes,
that is why it is challenged usually. Mm-hmm. Slaughterhouse-5, one of my favorite books from the
right.
list. Same reason. It gives people a tainted view of war. It seems that challenges to books often go in cycles. Whatever society is feeling really anxious about at the time, when there were the challenges against In Our Mother's House last year up in Davis County mm-hmm. with Patricia mm-hmm. Palacco, book, what people are thinking about and what people are really afraid of right now is gays and lesbians and
right.
gay and lesbian relationships and parenting in particular. And that was a book about two lesbian parents that was just too much for somebody to think about. But
right.
because these are hot issues, it is what writers who address issues of the day in any kind of format, picture books, novels, nonfiction, they're going to be writing about these things and talking about these things, because if, like Betsy said, if they are scary, we're going to be exploring them, and we should be exploring them.
And
that's
absolutely.
How we learn.
Right.
And one of the wonderful things that books do is create empathy. They take you into somebody else's world and show you the world from their perspective. And so if there are two gay parents, you are exposing the kids in a class to what that is like and who these people are, instead of excluding them from,
right.
you know, your world.
Yeah.
And that's what pulls people together. And speaking as a mother of a child with special needs, is no longer a child, but books like The Curious Incident of the Dog in the Nighttime, which expose people to what the world is like from someone with autism, from their point of view, just does wonders. That does more than any class, any lecture, anything else could ever do.
Yeah.
And that's why books are so important, because they create that empathy with other people's worlds.
Do you find, like in the case with this book in Davis County, I mean, that could happen in a lot of religious environments, not just Utah, but I imagine the Deep South or something as well, where there's just any community that's highly religious. Are there other examples that come to mind here in Utah that you two, run across through the years that were maybe uniquely us, or just showing that Utah is indeed just like a lot of other places, especially as we like to think of ourselves as?
I think it really does just show we're like other places. It's not like books aren't challenged anywhere else. They are, and as you mentioned, there's the Deep South, there's the Midwest, but there's also the East and West Coast. So it really depends upon the perspective of the people who want to limit the access.
And I actually think Utah does pretty well. I mean, everybody has such a negative vision of who Utah is and how we limit and how afraid we are. And actually, although there are groups who try to do that, on the whole, libraries have been so incredibly brave in standing up for books, and schools have. And I really think Utah, you know, you compare us to the Deep South and we get an A+.
Yeah.
I have two theories for that. One is that Utahns are just too polite. nobody wants to make waves here,
right?
If it's or something like that. And the other is that the predominant culture, the LDS culture, for whatever you think about them, they come from a background in which their core texts, their central scriptural texts, were challenged, were banned, their presses were busted up by mobs with torches. And maybe there's some sort of cultural resonance there because of that. I don't know. I am not LDS, so I can't say that, but that's one of my kind of weird dingy theories.
I mean, they certainly have a abiding faith in education in general.
That's what I was just going to say. They value education above
absolutely.
Almost all else.
And it comes through in different aspects beyond books and of music. I mean, incredibly musically inclined all the way back to the pioneer days. And it's a remarkable aspect of living here, certainly. As you two look at, you know, the big giant list of classics, I mean, what are the ones that really personally, I guess, resound with you? I mean, are there books on there that are, you know, a real, you know, a lifelong favorite that, you know, I'm always surprised when I see something and I'm like, Catcher in the Rye, I never really understood, other than I get, you know, basic.
It doesn't stand up that well over time either.
Yeah, right? Yeah.
You have to read it. It's just the right time in your life.
Right?
But Song of Solomon is one of the great novels of our time. All of Faulkner. I mean, Faulkner is so wonderful. And then Catch-22.
You know,
a sense of humor.
Right.
And sarcasm about
hilarious.
War,
right.
You know, those are things that are actually really valuable in our culture. And I'll say again, All the King's Men is one of the great.
Absolutely. Well, and I'm looking now, like, I'm not a fantasy. We were talking about Comic-Con earlier a little bit, and Lord of the Rings. I can't even begin to imagine
why
the rationale, other than it's scary witchcraft kind of things, the same reason that people went after Harry Potter books at one point, or what?
I think it's the completely overwhelming sense of mob mentality and violence. It's very frightening to people.
No, I would agree with that.
Interesting.
And also, they just hate the supposition of other worlds. That to them is evil.
Right.
Well, and the ultimate irony is Fahrenheit 451 usually is very high on these lists. The book about burning books is very consistently challenged and is, again, part of the canon of American literature. It's what people read in middle school, for heaven's sakes. And along with Animal Farm and 1984.
Right.
Again, these books about totalitarianism that are frightening precisely because they are about totalitarianism. And sometimes those are uncomfortable questions for us in society today.
Yeah, Catherine, you had mentioned Kurt Vonnegut before. Is that one that kind of has spoken to you, or is he an author that's
a favorite? Slaughterhouse Five, yes. Yeah. I think
he's
brilliant. Vonnegut is funny and wonderful and witty and irreverent. Slaughterhouse Five is a pretty serious novel in a lot of ways. A lot of Vonnegut is challenged a lot of times for language, being too weird and irreverent. But Slaughterhouse Five is particularly because of its pacifist content. Vonnegut witnessed the firebombing of Dresden, which was horrible, horrible, horrible. And he wanted to convey the horrors and helplessness of war and do it in a way that was accessible to a large number of people. So he wrote Slaughterhouse Five, and everybody should have to read that every time we think about going to war.
Absolutely.
And then here's a real irony. Can you imagine banning Ulysses? Because it isn't a book that commonly a lot of people read. It's a very difficult
to get
novel.
Through it is a challenge enough,
I happen
right?
to think yeah. it's brilliant, but it is not easy to read. And so you're going to get many more people to read it by putting it on a list like this, and it's number 6.
Right. Yeah, you know, that's amazing.
And then one other book that I wanted to mention that's on the recent list is the absolutely true Diary of a Part-Time Indian by
Jermaine Lucky. I just read this. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's such a wonderful book, and it's so wonderful for kids. And there are pictures, and, you know, you empathize with everybody in it.
Yeah.
And it is funny. It does everything you want a book to do to create that kind of empathy I was talking about.
Right.
How could anybody possibly ban that and stop kids from reading it?
Well, and they
or
even
adults.
Have the right. I just read that within the last few months, and you exactly brought it up the right way. It puts you in the position of this young man on the reservation and the modern reservation life. And then when I looked at the rationale they had here, I think it was like, oh, there's racism in the book. It's like,
This is I would say it's anti-racist, non-racist.
Exactly. That's sort of a twisted way to look at it in a way, but remarkable.
You can find a flaw, a thing to be afraid of in any book in the universe.
And that's the key. I think you were probably at the same event I was at in Denver at a book convention once when Laurie Halse Anderson was speaking about challenges, and she is one of the most challenged modern authors these days. She writes for young adults. She writes about difficult issues, and she is thus challenged all the time, and she talks with people who challenge her books, and she talks with people who defend her books, and she said that the unifying thing in all of the challenges it seems to be fear. People want to do the right thing. They really do, most of them. Right. Not all of them, but most of them want to do the right thing. They are trying to protect people, and they're just going about it the wrong way because they're afraid.
Right.
You know, there are some people in the world who are truly evil, I guess, but other than those people, people driven by fear do more harm than anybody else. Fear is just, it just seems to bedevil people into taking the wrong stand. And about books, I really believe that.
Well, and you totally strike a chord when you raise interest in these books when you start going
Absolutely.
Down that road, right?
Mm-hmm.
You're really helping get more copies out there into the public
eye.
Selling it's
books.
Remarkable, right?
Booksellers.
Part
of us loves it.
Yeah.
We do.
You're
going
to hire somebody to come pick it out front once a year, see what the hubbub's about. Well, that seems like a good natural pausing place. We'll be back in a few minutes and get back into Banned Books Week and the activities at your respective stores. This is your weekly daily calendar for the week of September 24th, and it's hard to believe we're barreling in towards the end of the month already, but so it goes. As always, you want to check out slugmag.com every day of the week to find out all the great events going on up and down the Wasatch Front. As I looked at the calendar this week, I found plenty of things for me to get involved with. Starting on Tuesday, September 24th, Steve Earle, talk about a rabble-rouser, Steve Earle and the Dukes, they'll be headlining at the State Room on that Tuesday, while over at the Urban Lounge, the Growlers, Hani El-Khatib, and Bass Drum of Death are playing. On Wednesday, September 25th, Venus and Fur opens at Run at Salt Lake Acting Company. That should be a great way to get the season started. At the same time, the 16th annual Utah Humanities Book Festival gets going at various venues all over town. And Chelsea Wolfe and True Widow, Chelsea Wolfe, the cover story of the current issue of Slug Magazine, she'll be playing at the Urban Lounge that night as well. On Thursday, September 26th, the Salt Lake City Film Festival gets started, also at venues all over town. Lots going on this week. Friday, the 27th of September, Musclehawk and Emma co-headline down at ABG's. That's one of the few bars in Provo. Well worth your trip. Always a good time down there. The Bell Furies bring Roots Rock to the Garage. That'll be a great show. And Drew Danbury headlines a CD release show at Velour down in Provo. Saturday, September 28th, the Greek Theater is doing Oedipus the King up at Red Butte Garden. This is a traveling show that starts at Westminster College, goes all over the state, ends up at two early morning shows, not that early, 9 a.m. That'll be on Saturday and Sunday this year. The Motown Sounds bring a little Motown music to the stateroom on Saturday the 28th. Sunday, September 29th, the Geek Show Movie Night is at Broovies. Not sure what they're showing. Always fun, though. Monday, September 30th, the Voodoo Organist at Burt's. That is a guaranteed good time. I've seen him a few times. And Cameron McGill and Paul Jacobson in the Madison Arm are playing at the Urban Lounge. Once again, check slugmag.com every damn day of the week to find out lots of great stuff going on around town. You can add your own listings there for free or for a mere $5 a month or $50 a year. You can add some quality links and content to those. We are back with Betsy Burton from the King's English and Catherine Weller from Weller Bookworks. And thank you once again for coming in. And let's dive in. Betsy, you had mentioned a lawsuit that you were involved in involving this issue of challenged books. Can you tell us a little bit of that?
Right. It was brought by the AG's office here. And the idea was that any book that was in a part of the store that children might walk into couldn't have any, you know, harmful to children content.
Right.
Well, so, you know, if a kid could walk into the fiction room and see Lady Chatterley's Lover or Catch 22 or you name it.
Right.
It was sort of, the punishments were so egregious. They were, I think, that racketeering law.
Mm-hmm.
Oh. They could seize your inventory. I mean, it was just
like you were like purveyors of pornography or
right,
something based
right.
on a book.
That wasn't even in the kids' room.
Right, right.
And so the people who got together to fight this were the ACLU and ABFE, which is our Foundation for Free Expression,
okay.
and the Media Coalition.
Mm-hmm.
And so they launched a lawsuit. And we were the main plaintiff originally, but we were thrown out early on because, you know, they had brought in some, I don't know, some people who sold magazines and whatnot, and we were considered, I think, too appealing to the public.
Oh, right, yeah.
So they threw us out.
Too
but,
familiar.
But by
yeah.
then, there had been a lot of publicity generated. And this was a hard-fought lawsuit that lasted for 8 years.
Oh, whoa. And when did this start? Do you remember?
Well, 8 years ago, but it was just yeah. decided last year.
Oh.
We were up at the legislature fighting for e-fairness, which is, you know, that the internet should pay taxes just
right.
like the rest of us.
Yeah.
And it came down then, so whenever
oh,
that
wow.
was. So it took a long time and
a lot of
taxpayer dollars.
Right.
And thank heavens they didn't win.
Yeah, no kidding. That sounds like one of those things our legislature finds a way to throw money at, well, at least once a session or something that just makes no sense.
Well,
sort of
it kind of encapsulates this issue, though, because I can totally understand parents not wanting their kids to be exposed to genuinely pornographic
oh, sure.
material.
Right.
But it's where you draw the line, and it, like everything in life, it's how to balance things. And balancing things by, you know, they took it to such an extreme
yeah.
that
swatting
was,
a fly with a 2x4
yeah,
kind of
exactly.
thing.
It would have been very harmful to all booksellers, all libraries. It would if. And all children.
Right, yeah. I mean, all of a sudden, every place has to redesign their whole store and or library to keep...
Well, God forbid some child should see a naked body.
Yeah.
I mean...
Can't have that.
Of course.
Can't have that.
Or read an adult novel with a love scene in it.
Right. Or a jokey, Catch 22,
or
a
right.
Kurt Vonnegut, unbelievable,
right.
yeah. Why don't we just tell the people a little bit about your respective stores and kind of what you see as your role in the community and what you guys provide that might be unique from each other and other stores around. Catherine, Weller Bookworks moved to Trolley
a little over a year and a half ago.
Yeah.
So we kept the core essences of our operation. We are the 21st century incarnation of Sam Weller's Books, which was originally Zion's Bookstore, which gives you an idea of how
the progression.
How much that has changed over time. What has been consistent since my father-in-law Sam took over the store is that it is a store that sells all kinds of books to all kinds of people. We sell new books, we sell used books, we sell rare books. So we've got $2 paperbacks. We have books that are tens of thousands of dollars. And we pride ourselves on being generalists. It's like call myself the last of the dilettantes. And sometimes I really feel that way. You know, I have all this surface knowledge about all of these things. Let's see, I'm losing my path.
Well, tell me a little bit about the move a little bit and sort of the challenges of staying a brick and mortar store in this day and age, let alone moving from, you know, a Main Street to off of Main Street in general.
Well, yeah, moving from Main Street to off of Main Street was challenging. That we had been in that Main Street location for 50 of our 82 years.
Yeah.
So it is the store that a lot of people remember.
Absolutely.
The people who are 70 and older remember when we were on Second South,
I
and
do.
It wasn't quite so, and Betsy's not 70, so I'm going a little high there.
I remember that move.
So it's been hard on that sort of group, this the sort of middle-aged Utah, the people who remember us on Second South. It's not such a stretch, but it was a necessary move. Downtown has changed, and we needed to be in a place that would facilitate people being able to get to us more easily, be able to honestly contract a little bit. The days of being able to have acres and acres of books, I think, are behind us, which is not to say that books are dying, it's to say that people aren't reading. It's to say that there are a multitude of new outlets, which is one of the challenges, but also that there are challenges to people's time. Those of us who still read, there are a lot of other things to do too, and so those of us who still read, many people actually read less than they used to, so it behooved us to become more selective in our generalist philosophy, and that's something we've endeavored to do in the new space. We've tried to keep a little bit of the old. Some of the visual things tie in, some of them don't.
It's a beautiful space. I mean, I really like
it.
I'm a fan of Trolley. I'm a fan of the store. Obviously, I used to work right next door to the one downtown. So it was a little painful to see a business that had made it through the tracks and all of that stuff, you know, and survived and
still. Well, barely. That's
right,
the thing.
A lot of people did not.
Really handicapped us over the years, and we could no longer wait for the great downtown renaissance that may or may not happen someday.
Right. Hopefully this is part of the Trolley Square renaissance.
And we love the historicity of Trolley Square. We like that it has that kind of old feel, like we had downtown in a way. There's that sense of time, which we think is important. Books are, I've said they're dangerous, but really they are ideas. Booksellers are the purveyors of knowledge and culture and ideas and beauty and truth and ugliness and grace and transcendence, everything in these packages that are so ideal for carrying around in your hands and opening up and closing and coming back to later. I love the physical book.
Yeah.
I really do. I love that I can sell ebooks and that Betsy can sell ebooks now, but I still love that physical book. And I don't ever want to turn away from those. And I think there are enough of us that the death of the book has been, what is that? The rumors of my death are premature. And the book can say that over and over again because it in itself is perfect technology.
Absolutely.
Some of the biggest challenges, aside from everybody carrying books these days, they're the nice gift items in the world.
Right.
They're little sidelines for everybody else.
Yeah.
Betsy talked about e-fairness, which is people paying tax on the purchases that they make over the internet. Somebody comes in that goes into King's English. King's English must, by law, collect sales tax.
Right.
That doesn't necessarily happen on an internet sales. Meanwhile, our infrastructure crumbles. Our city departments are challenged in their funding.
Right.
And people don't want to come to us because we charge them sales tax, which we do not. We collect their sales taxes to maintain their communities. And that is a challenge. Explaining that is a challenge to people.
Yeah, and I'll add to that that on the mighty Amazon, not only do they not collect sales tax, but they use books as loss leaders to sell digital equipment and refrigerators and you name it.
Yeah.
So they're taking a whole industry in one of the most important industries in our country and just throwing it under the bus to sell other things, which is painful to watch. But the thing about all of this that I really beg people to think about is locally owned independent businesses are the community.
Absolutely.
We are the bones of community. And if people, when they're thinking about saving that little bit of money because they're not paying sales tax, they need to think about what they're doing to their schools and their roads and everything else about our community. Because it's locally owned independent businesses who really do support the community. They support it with their money. They support it with, you know, their web of connection to everybody.
Absolutely.
They really are the heart of community. And I think more and more people are starting to understand that. But it's very important, and it's the argument that we have always made.
Yeah.
I want to say one other thing about our kind of business philosophy, because really our vision when we started was we want a place where people can come and where they can be comfortable. We had put chairs in every room and served coffee and tea, which we no longer do because there are coffee and tea places all over the place.
Right.
And we hired really knowledgeable booksellers, because what we wanted was a place. We wanted a community center. We wanted to be the heart of community for everybody who loved to read, and eventually for other people too, you know, bringing authors in. It's kind of what we all do. It's another really important thing about local business, that we really are community centers. And I like to tell the story about 9/11, that day when everybody was so shattered, our store was mobbed, and it was not because they wanted to buy books. They just wanted to be in a place where they could talk to each other.
Yeah.
And to me, that's what local businesses are all about. They're community centers. And I think that's a very important and highly underestimated part of what we do.
Do you find, it strikes me just carrying that theme that people, community-minded people, have certainly kind of tuned into that when it comes to things like locally sourced food at the restaurants they go eat and things like that. Is it harder to translate that idea, you think, for people to a retail store and like a physical product versus the farm-to-table type of thing?
It is and it isn't. I think Local First has been a huge force in this respect. I think people need to be educated in order to kind of make those connections, but I think once they're made, we both have fanatically loyal customers, because they don't want us to go away, because they really do understand how important we are to them, but also because they understand that whole idea that if local businesses disappear, we don't have an economy.
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
All that money that when Amazon collects, it isn't just about the taxes. They hire really nobody here except UPS drivers.
Right.
Every other penny they make goes out of state directly.
Right.
So.
And the big box stores out there are, not only are they getting like tax breaks probably to set up shop here, but they're not contributing at the same level.
Yeah, although Salt Lake City does not do that anymore. They really do understand all of that. The thing that I like to quote about big box, although it's important for all physical stores to still be here.
Yeah.
So, you know, in a way, we're partners where we were enemies before. But still, that said, we return 4 times as much to the economy as big box stores. And if that's a huge figure. And if you translate that to the internet, you know, which is exponentially worse.
Right.
It really says it all about community and what's happening to it.
Well, and you mentioned the ability to sell ebooks. How does that work for the local business that, you know, I mean, is
the
it just a matter
way.
Of just like any.
Get online and
get
order
on,
your books.
Right.
And we can
And it's just
them.
You guys wheel and deal with the publishers, or do they make that available to independent stores willingly?
Oh,
and
sure.
Often, yeah.
Sure. In fact, Amazon really has tried to put a crimp into that. I won't say it's Amazon. It's the anyway. We had an agency plan where we were on this equal footing with Amazon, and for some reason the DOJ decided that that was antitrust. Never mind the fact that, you know, Amazon has this huge monopoly.
Yeah,
if there is a de facto monopoly operator.
Yeah.
They
were
bringing it. They found in favor of it.
That's complicated.
But yeah, they just have to go. The important key here is they have to go to our respective websites to order the books and link through to the central database through us.
Okay.
And that way, we get a piece of those sales, essentially. We both sell devices as well. The devices are Kobo e-readers. And the Kobo philosophy is really nice. Their philosophy is read freely. It is usable across many platforms. You buy a Kobo book, you can read it on your phone. You can read it on any number of devices except for Kindles, because Amazon doesn't play.
Right.
You can read it on your PC. They really don't trap you into one format or another, which is wonderful. We love that.
Absolutely.
It's kind of a wonderful database. It's a very large database of books and free ebooks as well.
I'm with you on the physical book thing, though. Like, I've had a tablet for about a year, and I just can't I've read a couple books on it. It's not the same. I don't enjoy it. When I fall asleep, I drop it on my head. You know, it just
doesn't. It's not like going to bed with a book,
right? Yeah, not quite the same.
I wanted to mention one more thing that we're doing as an association. It's called Indies First, and it kind of ties into people's websites. We have this new program. It's going to be really launched on Small Business Saturday, which is a big day for us all, anyway. But all bookstores are bringing in an author, or maybe more than one author, to be a bookseller in their stores all across the country. But the other piece of it, that's part of it, is all these authors, and I hope all authors, are going to put on their website a buy button above the Amazon.
Oh, excellent.
And it's called Indies First. Indies only.
Indies first. Put them up first. In terms of the Banned Books Week festivities, they'll be going on right as this podcast goes out to the world. What do you have going at your respective stores in terms of, you know, displays and, you know, do people know when this week comes around each year and kind of start sniffing around for the
Catch
22 or whatever?
Well, we feature it in schools, but the ABA also sends out a big list and also a box of the physical books that are banned, so we can do displays with them. And so we make wonderful displays, and we like to trot them out when we go on, do presentations, and whether to libraries or just to community groups, and then to schools.
Okay.
Yeah, it would be really nice if there weren't Banned Books Week anymore, because books aren't challenged anymore, or because every week we are aware of the challenges to books in America. But that said, we put up displays once a week. They vary from year to year. We select banned books to feature books from various lists, books that have been challenged in Utah over time. Our booksellers are prepared to talk about it. We get out into the community and discuss it in hopes that someday we don't have to have this conversation anymore.
Right. Yeah, the week would go by the boards. It's a nice thought, that's for sure. Well, thank you both so much for coming in. Catherine Weller of Weller's Bookworks. Betsy Burton, King's English.
Thank you.
This was great. So glad that we could talk about this, and hopefully everyone will go out there and read some classics or look at last year's list and find something that's a little newer even, although some of those books are a few years old even, too. They're still getting kicked around, though.
Well, they'll be banned soon enough. There are plenty of new things you can choose from.
New things released every day for people to be offended by if they so choose.
That's right.
As always, thanks for listening to Soundwaves from the Underground, and for all things Slug Magazine, visit slugmag.com. In a few weeks, we'll have Jeffrey Stedman from Yelp Utah back in to talk about Halloween-related treats and goodies that you can find around town, and we want to hear what some of your favorites are. You can either send an email to soundwaves@slugmag.com or call and leave us a message on our automated voicemail line at 858-233-9324. That line is open 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. This podcast was created by Slug Magazine and produced by Gavin Sheehan. The associate producers are Esther Moronio, Alexander Ortega, and myself, Dan Nalen. The executive producer is Angela H. Brown. The theme was performed by Birthquake and recorded by Jesse Ellis. The main logo and art design is by T. Doan, and the technical design is by Kate Colgan. Be sure to fire us up again next week. We'll be talking about the Jung Society, the Utah Humanities Council, and the Utah Jazz's upcoming season with resident expert Mike Brown. Thanks for listening.